It's a Monday the 1st, and I'm sitting here with Peggy Horan at her beautiful home. And maybe we can just start, Peggy, by I wanted to describe a little bit, talk a little bit about where we are at the moment.
We're on Gorda Mountain on the south coast of Big Sur, about a half a mile up Gorda Mountain. And we're at our beautiful home that we got from the, Gregory Bateson. He actually built this home, and he and his wife and daughter lived here briefly, but he became ill and they couldn't stay here, although they kept the house. And they lived at Esalen, and his wife Lois used to walk by our garden at Esalen. Dick and I had a beautiful garden at Esalen, and we also had all these animals in a barnyard there. And she would admire Dick's garden all the time. She loved the garden. And she would talk to us about the place. And at one point we said to her, well, Lois, if you ever want to sell your Gorda Mountain home, we'd be interested. And this was long before they decided to sell it. So she kept that in her mind. And after Gregory passed away, she came to us and she said, okay, it's time. I'm ready to sell. And she sold it to us for a price that was affordable, which was amazing. And I was a little nervous about coming down to the South Coast. It was far from my friends in Esalen and where I worked. And we had no power. We had no phone. And I was a midwife at the time. And so I thought, well, how's that going to work, you know? And also we had no water. So we just sort of a big leap of faith, although Dick knew there was water here. And that was in 1981. Wow. Yeah, and we've been here ever since.
So what? And so if I ask you to describe the room or the house that we're in, what does it look like?
Oh, the house is this wonderful sort of artist-built house. It was built by Warren Leopold, who was an amazing architect and builder from Cambria. And it's shaped like a mandala. If you look down on it from above, you can see the form. There's a big central room that's a big square. And then in the middle of each side of the square, there's a room that goes off of it, same size on all sides. So it's perfectly geometrically designed. And then in the center, there's a skylight at the point in the center. The roof is sort of, I don't know how you describe this roof. It's a pointed roof. Yeah. It's kind of a high ceiling. And one of Gregory's sons did the stained glass for the skylight. And all the windows were made by Warren. So there's nothing, everything is handcrafted. There's nothing that was purchased. No doors, no windows. Everything was handcrafted by Warren. And each door and each window have a little point at the top. And he just did the most amazing design, and it has a big stone fireplace, which is gorgeous. Doesn't really work effectively to warm the house, but it's beautiful to look at, and it's cozy to sit near it. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, we have a gas heater as well. When we moved in, the house was not quite finished. The bathroom wasn't complete. The roof was a plywood roof with paper on it. That was all. So it leaked like crazy. The first few years we were here, we had every pot in the house on the floor catching the leaks. And you can see the stains on the ceiling. They're kind of pretty, actually, where the water went through. At some point, some money came our way, and we put a new roof on, a tile roof that was fireproof, and that was wonderful. So we solved the roof problem. And then we also finished the bathroom and changed that a little bit. Otherwise, the house was pretty complete.
Wow. Yeah. 81, you said. So let's just rewind here, Peggy, because this is exciting to see how you ended up in this extraordinarily beautiful place and in this fantastic house. So where did you originally come from? Where are you born? Where did you grow up?
I was born in New York City, and I grew up in the suburbs of New York and spent my, well, till I was 18 there, went off to college, then moved to New York City, graduated from Columbia University in New York City, and stayed there for 8 years or so, where I was working in film and photography as a stylist, which is somebody who runs around and gets the props and the clothes, and was very fun.
Yeah.
Very fun. I had a little motor scooter, and that was my means of transportation, and I was all over the city. I was married, had a lot of fun. We had a great time, went to ski every weekend or went somewhere, took off from New York, had a really fun New York life. And then I discovered Esalen.
How?
I was gone.
How did that happen?
Well, I heard about it, and we were filming a lot in L.A., and I knew it was in California, and the cameraman, who was a very good friend of mine, had been to Esalen. He had also done a film on Fritz Perls in New York, and he said, you've got to go there. You're going to love this place. And so he put me on a plane and sent me up there, and that was about 1966 or something. Esalen was only a few years old. Mm-hmm. And so I came there, and I was just enchanted and enthralled, and I couldn't believe where I was, and that was the beginning. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember the first time that you drove the coast? Did you come from the south or the north that time?
That time I came from the north, from Monterey. But it was evening. And this wonderful man, Ed Taylor, picked me up at the airport. I flew up from L.A. And he had this long, flaming red hair and this flaming beard and very few teeth and the biggest, sweetest smile you ever saw. And he was there to meet me and bring me to Esalen. In those days, there were so few people that went, they could chauffeur you in, you know. And so he picked me up, and he brought me down the coast and talked to me about Esalen on the way, and it was wonderful.
And you spent the night, the first night, and then the next morning you woke up. Do you remember how that felt?
No,
that first
I actually don't remember. I remember, I don't remember the way it was. I can't even remember where I stayed that first night or how that was. But I remember being there that weekend, and I remember the lodge and the warmth of the lodge and all the interesting people. And I took a workshop from Fritz Perls. It was called, I forgot what it was called. But anyway, it was a weekend workshop. And he, of course, was the Gestalt, father of Gestalt therapy, and a very exciting, cutting-edge therapist. He was an old guy, smoked a lot of cigarettes, and he was very direct, wasted no time. And I was one of maybe 50 people, and it was, of course I was scared to death. And there was a hot seat, and you got up in the hot seat, and then he would work with you. So I watched all weekend as people got up in the hot seat, and some people he was beautiful and compassionate with, and other people he was brutal. And the difference was, if you were being real with him, he was really there for you in the most beautiful, compassionate way. And if you were just bullshitting him, he called you on it immediately. It was fascinating to watch him. And finally, I got up there, scared to death, but I said, I got to do this. I'm here, you know. And I was one of the bullshitters. So he called me on it quickly. But it was a great experience. It was wonderful. And I was just in love with the place and the people. And there was music everywhere, and people were friendly and high. And, oh, my God, it was just, you know, incredible. And so I went back to New York, but I kept coming back to workshops. Brought my husband. He felt the same way. But, you know, it was the 60s, and things were changing, and we both kind of ended up going our separate ways. And 4 years later, I moved back there and to Big Sur and to Esalen.
Were you living then with your husband on Manhattan itself?
Yeah, we were living in New York City.
Yeah,
but I just was so called to come back here.
Do you remember? Can you talk a little bit about the process that you went through personally to make the decision?
Oh, it was brutal. It was brutal because all my attachments were back there. My husband, my family, my mother and my dad, my brother, all my aunts and uncles. You know, I had a big family. I had a job, my friends, everything. I mean, my whole life was there. And I really didn't know what I was doing. I could not have defined it. you know, my parents would ask me, you know, what are you looking for? And I just didn't know what I was really looking for was myself, but I couldn't verbalize that at the time. I just knew that I was just filled with this longing to go back to Big Sur and that I wasn't happy. And I sort of blamed it on external things, you know, my husband or my work or whatever, whatever. But that wasn't really what it was about. It was really about me sort of breaking out of the mold. I was raised in a sort of a conservative Jewish family in the suburbs of New York and in the 50s, and everybody was very conforming, and there were things that you did and expected of you and blah, 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 blah. And I really needed to break out of all that. It wasn't me. It wasn't what I was feeling.
This was also the years of doing that,
It was culturally, the 60s, yeah. So that was all starting, and I just went, wow, you know, I like all that. That sounds good. You know, there was like this wave just took me from the East Coast to the West Coast, following that energy and the sort of self-discovery. And there were drugs, too. We started doing drugs back then.
Yeah.
And pot and mescaline and acid. And my husband and I were partners in a house with a bunch of other friends. And on weekends, we'd go up to this house and we'd take acid every weekend. Well, that just broke through, you know, tons of stuff and made the journey a lot quicker. So, and it was interesting because we all kind of ended up changing our lives after that last summer. He ended up coming out here after me, and he still lives in California, and all of our other friends did something else too. So that was very instrumental. It was the times, yeah.
So then when you decided to move, what was the setup? I mean, what did you come to? Did you have a job?
I had covered.
Okay.
I ran into an old boyfriend.
Okay.
He was a guy I used to ski with in Vermont. Always had a crush on him, but we never really got together back then. And I ran into him crossing the footbridge at Esalen one time when I was there. I don't remember which time. And we were both just shocked to see each other. Like, what are you doing here? In a million years, I never would have thought I'd run into him. And so we started, you know, reconnecting. And I told him that my intention was to come back. And he lived in the annex of the big house, which actually was two rooms. It had an upstairs and a downstairs. And he said, you can come here. He was renting from Bunny and Tom Grease. The house was owned by Dennis Murphy at the time. And he said, you can come and stay here. So I had a place to land, and that's what I did. And he had a girlfriend at the time, but soon she moved on, and now I moved downstairs, and we spent a couple of wonderful years together.
Wow.
In the beginning, yeah.
And so did you start your professional development? I mean, you started thinking about what you were going to do, too, like for a living? And
absolutely not. No. I was so uninterested in what I was going to do for a living. I had a little bit of money saved, not very much, and Larry had money enough, you know. And what I was interested was taking drugs, taking acid, finding out about all the psychedelic world and what was going on at Esalen. I took a long 3-month program. It was sort of the precursor to what's now the Work Scholar program. Was one of the early programs where I did a lot of exploration into what was going on at the time, and that was really interesting to me. And then when that was over, I had to go to work, so I got a job in the kitchen, but I hated it. I didn't know how to cook, and my first assignment was to make 11 lemon meringue pies. And the cook, the man who ran the kitchen, Ron Martin, he was kind of a drunk, and he got great joy out of watching me suffer and wouldn't help at all, and it was a disaster. And that was my first baking experience. But I was put on as the chef for dessert making and salad making, and so that was my first job. But I hated it, and I lasted about 3 months, and then I quit, and then I discovered massage. And made that switch and started doing massage, and that was it. That was what I loved and where I belonged, and was a good fit.
And it's something that you've continued to do for a long, long time, mm-hmm. right?
I have. I've done massage ever since then. I took a little time out having children, and when I was midwifing, I did a little bit less. And then when Rachel and I had the shop up in Loma Vista, I took about 8 years off and just worked a little bit. But I always kept my foot in the door, mm-hmm. just maybe one day. And I love it. I still love it to this day. So mm-hmm. it really found something that was right for me.
Before we go back on to the mm-hmm. other story, can you talk a little bit then about after many years of doing massage, what do you think is the most important virtue and beauty and meaning of massage?
Well, in the practice, I think it's bringing people closer into themselves, to their bodies, to their souls, to how they feel. Making people feel good is you know, what you do, really. But hopefully in that process, people become more aware of themselves physically, emotionally, mentally, spiritually. And it's a meditation. It's truly a meditation in being present and being aware of who I'm working with, aware of myself as I'm working. Mm-hmm. But it's a moving meditation. It's a practice. It's not just a job, you know. And I think that's what satisfied me all these years. It satisfies my soul, whereas, for instance, retail was just, you know, dreadful,
right,
you know, for me. Yeah, it just didn't work at all. But massage does, and I love teaching. I love passing it on, particularly now that I'm older and passing it on to young people. I really enjoy teaching, and so it's developed over the years and changed, and still interesting to me. And people are just fascinated by that. How can you still be doing the same thing at your age, and how can you physically be doing it? Well, physically, I think I've got good genes, but I also know how to relax and use my body in a way that doesn't wear me down. And so I've been lucky in that way. And, yeah.
Do you have any particular, memory of individuals or, you know, moments in doing massage that are particularly memorable?
Well, I think the first massage I ever gave, the man became tearful because he had never experienced being touched that way.
Right.
It was very powerful.
Yeah.
And whenever that happens, it's very powerful mm-hmm. and moving, and it does happen. Sometimes there's a very deep connection with people. And other times not, but I think I remember that so clearly.
Hmm. What about what that reminds me right away of the sexual aspect? How, just talk a little bit about that then, if you're giving massage to a man and who, like you say, have never been touched, perhaps at all. There's definitely a very short distance between that and sex, the
yeah.
sexual impulse and getting an erection and getting horny. How did one or does one deal with that as a...
Well, you learn. That's
yeah.
part of becoming a professional. In the old days, the boundaries were very fuzzy. When I began massage, first of all, we worked naked in those days.
Right.
I can't believe it myself now, but we did.
Yeah.
And so the boundaries were just... And plus, in the 60s, there were no boundaries anyway, and in the early 70s. So we kind of went through all that. And then began to emerge into a different consciousness and started creating more boundaries, realized that, you know, the energy that we put out is the energy that determines what happens in the session. And if we are professional and clean and clear in our boundaries, the client understands that and for the most part will not try and overstep that. If they do, then there's a protocol for shutting them down. If an erection happens, it happens. We can't help that, and we don't say anything. We just move on to a different part of the body, keep going. It happens. It doesn't happen like it used to happen because massage has changed. In the old days, the massage was much more sensual, too, than it is now. Now it's a little bit more therapeutic, a little more deep tissue. In the beginning, it was very sensual. And, you know, that was what was happening. The 60s, people were waking up to their senses. That was part of the whole awakening of the of that movement in that time. So it just fit with the times. But we've adjusted over the years. In the 80s, we started getting a lot of clients who had been sexually abused. And this was a whole thing that was beginning to, people were beginning to speak about and get help and therapy with. So, again, we had to really learn about that and learn how to deal with people and how to be incredibly mindful and considerate when working with these people and what to do and not do. And so we've learned over the years boundaries for ourselves and for our clients. And in that way, it's changed a lot. And so what used to be much more sexual experience is really not now. It's very rare to have people, you know, respond that way because they get what we're doing. They get
the first thing. The first words you mentioned actually when we started talking about this was more. You very quickly mentioned the spiritual aspect of it, or the sort of therapeutic on a mental level. So talk about that. I mean, you are not yourself talking to people as a therapist. Using words, particularly as a masseur,
No.
But it's a result of it.
You're conveying a feeling, you know. You're conveying what you're feeling. Mostly, it's love, you know. I'm relaxed in myself and centered and grounded, and so I'm passing that to them, and I'm also being tender and showing love to them, and. You know, as I said before, many people have not experienced touch in that way, so it can become very, very healing and very deep for people. And people who are up here in their heads and you know, operating in this world through their minds are able to respond by sinking into their body and beginning to feel emotionally, physically, spiritually something different. And you know, they come into a very, very deep peace in themselves that they maybe have never felt before. Deeply peaceful and sort of one with things. And kinds of things like that happen.
And this was something that you discovered yourself, both by giving and probably also receiving quite a bit of massage.
Yeah,
right?
Receiving too, definitely. Mm-hmm.
I mean, in the early days, in your practice, when you learned from others, you must have received in order to learn as well.
We did. Right. We did. We had classes with Seymour Carter, who's now passed on, was one of my teachers, a woman named Storm, who lived up on Partington Ridge. Mm-hmm. She was one of my teachers, and we got a lot of massage. We traded a lot. And still, to this day, I do, and I learn from everybody I work with.
Right.
You know, everybody I receive from and everybody I give to, I learn. So there's no end to it. It's not like you got it. Okay, now you got it. You don't ever got it.
No.
You keep getting it.
Yeah. So let's get back to when you first got there back in the 70s. 1970?
69.
So you came to in 69. Were you at the celebration? Did you make that, or did you... You remember the concert with...
I don't think I was at the 69 when I was there at the next one.
Mm-hmm.
That was amazing. No, I got there in the end of 69, like November. I remember that. I remember coming up. I had a friend at some little institute down in San Diego, and he drove me up to Big Sur. We spent one night at Deachin's, and then he dropped me off at Esalen. And then that was it. I'm here.
And you were here since.
And here since, But there was something about Esalen. I don't know exactly what the place, the people. There was some integrity that I felt there that was new to me, and I felt it in myself, but I felt it in the place, physically in the place. And I knew that it was a place that I could learn to be honest with myself and with the world and with relationships in a way that I hadn't before. You know, my New York life was so different. Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of accommodating going on all the time. And so that was part of learning who I was, you know, learning how to be honest with who I am and be okay with who I am and come from that place in my relationship with others. And so I think it was really in the land, because actually in the day there were so many stoners around, there were so much drugs and so many pills being passed that there was a lot of spiritual tyranny going on, you know, people who thought they had the truth and knew the truth because they were a little confused by all the drugs they took, you know. Mm-hmm. But there was something beyond all that that I could feel there that I knew I would get for myself if I stayed there. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the real ultimate draw for me, was that feeling of this place has integrity. Deeply mm-hmm. rooted.
Mm-hmm. You could see beyond the surface of all the the flitting about of trying out different spiritual movements.
Yes, and I was never attracted to them. It took me a long time to kind of find my way through the workshop thing. And Larry, my boyfriend, when I was first there, ran off to a Rika training in Chile, and he said, "Do you want to go?" And I said, "It's the last thing I want to do now. You know, I just finished a 3-month course, and I thought I'm here to figure out me. I don't want a guru. I don't want to sit at the foot of a guru and have him tell me how it is. I'm going to figure that out myself." So I resisted teachers for a long time, you know.
So Larry left? Is that when you started separating?
He left, went off to Chile, and it was very funny, actually. I took him to the airport. And there was a girl from Partington whose name I forgot. They were both late. The training had started, and they were maybe a month into the training. But an opening happened, and they got the opportunity, so they decided to go. And I took them to the airport, and she and he got on the plane. And I was standing there at the airport watching them go and sort of waving goodbye. And I had been very sad he was going, very broken up. Oh, my God, my boyfriend's leaving, the big drama, you know. And then there was this guy standing next to me, and he looked over and he said, "Hi." And it was Cass. Did you ever know Cass? And I said, "Hi." And he said, "You want to ride back to Big Sur?" Well, he was so cute.
He's so handsome, yeah.
He was so cute, and I was so tempted to just ditch the car and go with him. Yeah. But I mean, that's how quickly I was over it.
Right.
I was amazed at myself. I couldn't believe it. Really? You know? But I didn't go home with Cass.
Yeah.
Always a little sorry about that.
Yeah.
And then Dick and I got together shortly after that. Well,
number one, what was your name at this time? I forget.
Morrison.
Morrison, right.
Yeah. Dick was there. He had been there. He had been on the massage crew. He had run the massage crew. And he actually hired me when I got on the massage crew. He was the boss, and I said, "I want to get on the massage crew." And he didn't. It was Janet Letterman who was kind of the boss at the time. And he stopped doing massage, although we started teaching workshops together in massage, yoga, and meditation, and that was really fun. But then he stopped doing massage because he was really interested in being an artist and not massaging people. And he wasn't particularly interested in Esalen. He had been there a few years. And so he sort of gravitated to the barn where there were other artists. John Horler, Horst Mayer, Carl Lee had been there. He'll fill you in on the others. But so he started doing that. And but he asked me after, this was after Larry had left, he said, "You want to trade massages?" So that was his come on, of course. And, you know, from there we just took off, fell in love, and we lived in a wonderful little treehouse that he built on the side of the cliff below where the farm is now. And it was built sort of in the crotch of a great big cypress tree, and he put a platform in, and I think his friend Tony Wagner helped him build it, and they Tony, I think, lived up above in a funny little tree house, and they built this one down below in the crotch of this tree, and he built a bed. I remember the tree trunk kind of came up right next to the bed, and then he had a little stove and a little a wood stove for fire, and then a little gas stove for cooking. And then right outside, there was a tiny little platform with an outhouse just sort of right on the edge of the cliff there. And that's where we lived.
So the poop went into the water or into the creek beneath?
I think so. I'm not sure where it went. I think it did.
Yeah.
Down the side of the cliff.
Yeah.
And we lived there with his dog, Kelly. And Kelly got pregnant. And the saddest thing happened. She had 13 babies or something. And they all died. They all fell off the cliff. It was so steep there.
Yeah,
that she didn't make it. She made it, but the puppies didn't. But anyway, we were there for a couple of months, and Gabrielle, who had been his former girlfriend and who they had a son together, Jonathan, decided to go to New York to the Eureka training. So she asked Dick if we would like her house, which was the little, now called the Jade House, next to the barn, and if we would like to have Jonathan along with the house. Jonathan was 2.5, I think. Yeah, about Nadi's age. He was a little guy.
Yeah.
Maybe he was 1.5. I can't even remember. I think he was 2.5. So we moved in. And
With Jonathan. So you're a family of three.
We were a family of three. And I had not thought about having children. That was way distant for me. I wasn't there yet at all. But I was going for it. I would do anything. I was into Dick. So whatever was happening, I was going with it. So we moved into Gabrielle's house. She just kind of blew out of there. Everything was left, you know, her whole life was left in the house, and we just moved in and started nesting there. And Jonathan then went, she got settled in New York, and he would go back and forth between us. She would call and say, you know, I'm arranging to have him come. He can come at this time. And then we would arrange the airline thing and back and forth. And he would come back and forth, visit us, visit her. And that went on for a long time, maybe 7 years or so. And then she finally got married and settled down in New Jersey when Johnny was about 9. And then he moved back there with her and only spent summers with us.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so much fun having him. And I started to get into family then. I thought, well, this is fun. I think I'll have some of my own. And Dick was like, no, I already have a kid. I said, yeah, you do, but I don't. So that was when Lucia came along.
Uh-huh. What year is Lucia coming along?
Lucia was born in 76.
Okay. So just a parenthesis, Eureka has had a couple of very strong indirect impacts on your life.
Yes, yeah. Very strong.
Yeah.
And I was never drawn to Eureka.
Two individuals
all.
Disappearing.
Like
good timing.
And exactly. Very strong. And then Eureka finally came to Big Sur. They did a thing up at Barclay's house. It wasn't Barclay's house. It was Jack Downing's house at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they did a training up there, and local people took that.
Yeah. So you just then 76, you said. So that is how many years you've been together for 6 years.
We've been together for 6 years. Yes,
right.
Five or six. Yeah.
So Dick is okay then, or is it? Did you trick him into it?
Yeah, I don't know if I really tricked him into it. No, he wasn't okay at all. He kind of flipped out and started chasing women.
Ooh.
He picked up with an old girlfriend. And when Lucia was a month old, he went off. But he came back, and he wanted it both ways, you know. And that didn't fly. So I think that girlfriend, I can't remember how the sequence went. She was somebody I knew, too. She had used to be at Esalen. And then he came back, and he was home and with us. But he was very distracted. And he went on a journey and started chasing work scholars around and women at Esalen.
Mm.
And we had a very difficult year. And that was Lucia's first year of life. And finally, he moved out with a work scholar. They moved up to Crinkle Corners, lived there for a very, very short time, and she dumped him. She was into stuff that he wasn't into, and it didn't work out. So he kind of came back with his tail between his legs, and door was open. I was waiting for him. Mm. So that was a very difficult time for me, particularly. Mm-hmm. And I started to look around and man, and it was just so weird. I was nursing this child, and I thought, well, now I understand why people stay together and have families. I mean, here I have this newborn baby and there's men coming around, and this isn't right, you know.
Yeah.
Nothing worked. I had a good friend who I had a little fling with, but it just never was right, it never felt right. I mean, she was what I was into and what I cared about, and she was first. So eventually, he calmed down for a while.
Meanwhile, you were able to stay at the house.
Able to stay at the house. Yeah, it was because I was the employee. He wasn't employed at Esalen at the time. So I was the one employed there. And gazebo had just been built. So that was very fortunate because gazebo was right across the street from us. So we had this fabulous preschool, and Lucia could start going there when she was maybe a year old or so.
Right.
And that was wonderful. And
as far as the practical life for you, I mean, it was a tough year for many reasons, but just on a practical level, did you have to go to town yourself a lot?
Yeah, I had to go to town myself with the baby, and I was always nervous about that. And Honey Rose was my dear friend and my midwife. She had delivered Lucia, and she took me. I often went with her, and she was a big support for me during that time, as was Vicky Topp, who was a neighbor and was really close. Stephanie Healy was living with John Horler in the barn. She was really close. So sometimes I would go with somebody else. But I did. I mean, practically, and there was a fire that summer, too. There was a fire that, 76, there was a big fire. And I was terrified, I didn't know how close it would come. It didn't come so close, but that was very scary. And I had Jonathan that summer. And so Jonathan didn't know what was up. He was 7, I think, or I don't know how old he was. And he was going back and forth. Yeah, he was about 7. So he'd go and spend time with Dad and this woman, and then he'd come back with me. And he was trying to figure out what was going on. He didn't know. He was just there responding to the moment. It was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
It was crazy. Yeah.
Meanwhile, at that time, you also you're continuing to do your work at Esalen as much as you can.
Yeah, and I had a lot of support there. I mean, I had a good support system, friends and other mothers. Those days, there were a lot of more families at Esalen, so I had a lot of mothers around and friends and people, and Brita and Ivy came and lived with me for a little while between homes. They stayed. That was really fun. So there were some fun things, There were moments that were fun, but I was always ready for him to come back. I knew that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I'm trying to go chronologically here in a way, it's kind of funny, but, we have the gap here between 70 and 76. The years that you and Dick are living without, you have Jonathan, but are you mainly, talk about those years a little bit. I mean, if there's anything in particular that you think about those years, it'd be fun to talk about.
Well, he was developing his pottery at Esalen, in the barn, and the barn was kind of coming together with other artists, and I was practicing massage, doing massage, and just sort of living life. I was learning to cook and bake. I was into baking bread. And we had a farm over where the farm is now. He built a beautiful fence, and we had a barnyard over there. So we had goats and sheep, and we had a little business. We were milking goats, making cheese, selling goat milk and yogurt and cheese. And we had eggs, chickens and eggs, and we had geese, and we had a garden, and we had lambs. So we were doing that whole back to the land movement. Beautiful garden, And so I was learning about all that. I mean, I was a city girl. I didn't know anything about gardens and sheep and goat milk. And
small. Eggs. Small is beautiful.
Yeah. So, and Bunny Grease had taught me to cook, so I was really into cooking and enjoying that a lot. So I was just sort of developing in that country life kind of way. That was sort of my focus in those years. And I was focused on him and, you know, and us. And
what about culturally? Music, you know, whatever, the poetry, music, the books you were reading, people you meet, cultural life. What
music was a big part of it. Dick was into the drums, and I got into belly dancing. Mm-hmm. And that completely captured me. I was passionate about that, completely captured me. And what happened was there was a young woman at Esalen who was a belly dancer, and she used to go into Huxley in the morning and practice while there was quiet before breakfast. And I would sometimes be going to do an 8 o'clock massage, and I'd hear the music and go over and watch her. And I said, "You got to teach me. I want to know how to do this." And so she did. So then I can't remember her name. Sylvia. Mm-hmm. Sylvia. And she was fabulous. And so she taught me, and then we started bringing in teachers, and the whole group started forming, and local people, and we started this whole Friday afternoon belly dancing lessons and class, and people would bring their children. The Esalen was so open in those days. We just let them know at the gate, Friday afternoon is belly dancing in Huxley. We'd clean the room or get it back together so that the cleaning people didn't have to worry about it, and we'd have either live musicians, Dick, Richard Villa, Brock, and Barkley, and we'd have either live music or we'd have tape music. And different teachers would come in and out. And eventually a woman named Lynn something or other showed up, and she had had a troupe. So she decided we would become a troupe. So she put us together as a troupe, and we had this fabulous group of women dancers, and we practiced every week. We met at different places. We had musicians coming in and out, but we had sort of a core group.
Who were the girls?
The girls were Teresa, Don Case's wife, whose name popped out of my head, beautiful woman. She did the sword dance. Lynn danced with the snake. She had a cobra. Judy Scher. Linda Padilla, mm-hmm. myself, I think Candace Romanow, and maybe that was Lindsay's wife mm-hmm. at the time, mm-hmm. maybe
Pamela?
Cheetah, no, maybe Cheetah, Jaime's Melanie Lerner, mm-hmm. that was a little later. And Patty Villa.
Patty Villa. And not Mary Lou.
Mary Lou was a little later, right?
I did African more.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You came to the classes, I think, though.
Right, I was too shy.
You were too shy. I have pictures. I have to show you Facebook pictures from Brock of you dancing. Not so shy.
<That's awesome>.
Yeah. So that was the original troupe, and we had so much fun.
Yeah.
And so although I was going through this terrible time with my husband, I had this, and he was sort of in and out, because once he took off with this other woman, he didn't show up, which was fine with me. And then we had people like, what was his name on Partington Ridge? David, played a beautiful violin. He was a classical musician.
Oh.
David Abel.
And
somebody invited him to come, and that was amazing. Oh, and then Richard Anderson, who played the clarinet. And so we had different people. Some other guy who used to live here played the clarinet. His name I forgot. So different people would come in and out, but we had kind of a core group, and the dancers were the same. So we practiced all the time. We performed at Nepenthe, the Cafe Amphora, on Sunday afternoons. And we've got a local turnout, you know. I'll show you a picture. We've got a picture of us right here. And people would come. Mostly our friends showed up.
And that is beautiful. Who is this?
That's me.
That is you?
Yes, me.
Wow.
That was taken by Douglas Mattson. And
oh, yeah.
It was up in his house, and when he died, John gave it to me.
Of course.
Oh, John danced with us, too. Uh-huh. Not all the time, but he performed a little bit.
Wow.
Remember John Lemore danced with us? Yeah.
That's so great.
Yeah. So that was at the cafe.
Uh-huh.
And so that really filled my life, mm-hmm, that time. Mm-hmm. It was so much fun and so inspiring, and I was just passionately into it. I mean, I wanted to. I learned to play the zills and learned some of the rhythms on the drum. And Dick made beautiful drums. He made them out of clay, and then he'd take very thin skin and he'd make the heads, and oh, they were gorgeous. And he played the drum, and so that was very fulfilling. And that went on for a while. Oh, it went on through the next few years, because when I was pregnant with Jasmine, I was still dancing. And I have some great pictures that Brock took of that performance I did right before I gave birth at Esalen. And so we continued on. And then about 79, 80, it kind of fell off. And then it transformed from the, I think Lynn moved away, and it sort of transformed to the Natives, and it became a whole other thing.
Right.
And then Teresa sort of led that, mm-hmm, into another phase.
Mm-hmm.
Belly dancing was sort of done at that point.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a moment in time,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like so many moments. Yeah.
God.
Fabulous moment in time.
It seems like it's so much, to me, when you mentioned the I mean, I wasn't here, of course, until 84, but the Natives, It isn't that long ago, I suppose, that the Natives really disbanded. I mean, it's not that many years ago.
They had an evolution. Dick played with them for a while, and it didn't work out. You know, musical groups, you know.
Of course, yeah.
See, come egos, yeah. Pissing contest.
Yes, yes. People come and go. And
people come and go.
Yeah.
I mean,
Teresa really was the person who kept it together.
She did.
For all the years.
For all the years, and she was the... You know, get the dancers and the costumes, and just she had so much creativity and expression through the Natives. And we did some stuff with them. I mean, Linda and I danced a couple times at the River Inn, and I used to, when Dick was playing with them, I played Shaker Ray and the tambourine. I always played the tambourine. So we participated for a bit with the Natives, and then he had a big falling out, and that was sort of the end of it for us. But Teresa and I remained friends. It was their thing, the boys' thing.
Yeah. So you said Jasmine came along in 79?
79.
And so that's just a year before, or 2 years before you come up here, or a year before. Was it 80 or 81 you got
81.
Here?
We 81. Got married in 80.
Yeah.
We got married at Esalen in 80. Jasmine was 8 months old.
Mm-hmm.
And then we bought this house and moved here in 81.
Right.
So she had 1 year there.
So you were a family of four living at Esalen.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh. Rare thing now.
Yeah, yeah.
There were other families, though, at the time. And, you know, thank God for Gazebo, because, you know, Gazebo happened because Janet Letterman was an educator, and she was passionate about her work, and she was brilliant, and she always wanted her own school.
Mm-hmm.
She worked in... you know, the L.A. ghettos and different places. And Dick Price obliged by becoming a father. And Jenny Price was born in 78 or 77, one of those years. And Gazebo happened
right
after that.
Yeah.
So that worked out really nicely for us.
Yeah.
And it was another reason why it was sort of hard for me to come down here, because I had Gazebo there. But I would drive the kids up there, and they would still go to Gazebo.
Mm-hmm.
But Dick really wanted to be on the South Coast. He didn't like the North Coast. It was too social for him. There were too many people, and there was too much of that business going on, and he couldn't relate. And down here, it was still sort of wild and woolly, and Gorda Mountain was very untamed, and this suited him.
Mm-hmm.
And we could afford it, so that's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
There was a time where we almost left, well, not almost, but we did look outside of Big Sur up in Northern California, And he liked it very much. I couldn't relate. It was just too remote for me, and I had a life here, and I just didn't want to be there. So we were lucky.
Yeah, this is certainly it's a wonderful place here. You're kind of right in between shopping in San Luis Obispo and Monterey.
Yes, in the middle.
Yeah,
but we have Cambria, which is only 40 minutes away.
Right.
So we're not, I mean, having been here all these years, I don't feel at all isolated now.
Right.
And we've managed to draw people in. Our dear friend Myrtle Franklin owned the property that Bunny lives on. When Myrtle decided to sell, we got Bunny in line, and she bought it. So then Bunny came on board. And then when Jaime and Melanie divorced, she had 15 acres for sale. Robin and Billy came on. So, gradually we've drawn people in.
Yeah.
And there's been some rough years with neighbors and such, Big Sur, Big Sur. But it's really worked. And Dick has just spent many, many hours developing this place and, putting in gardens and landscaping and working on it. And then he built his shop out there. We put in two little cabins for the girls so that they each had their own space as they became teenagers. And we had several other kids living here. We had Billy Rose was here for a couple years, a year, and then Hope Rose spent 3 or 4 years with us when the family dissolved, so we had three kids in that little tiny room in there for a while, and then we started building these cabins, and Lucia moved into hers, and Jasmine moved into hers, and Hope was still there, and then when Hope turned 18, she finally moved to town, and that became my room. So we've developed this place a lot, and then we took the old original cabin that was the first place ever built on the property and lived in by, a million people, Indian Joe, all kinds of people in the old days, and it's down in the Redwoods, and Jonathan lived there for a while, and some other friends of ours lived there. We finally decided to just renovate it. So from the bottom up, Dick and some friends started working on it, and they secured it to the ground and put a good foundation, and then we got a carpenter, and we renovated the place, expanded it, made it bigger, built the bathhouse, and now we're renting it.
Perfect.
Yeah, so it's lovely. It's really worked out nicely. And unlike other, vacation rentals, this one has not ruffled any feathers. We have a very quiet, two people only, don't walk in the neighborhood. There's a trail right out to the Crookshank. It's just been very contained and tight.
Cool.
Pay our taxes. Mm. It's floating the boat. I mean, we're very lucky to have it, because it's definitely working for us.
So, lots of changes over the years, but this place has also, in many ways, been beautifully staying the same at the same time, right?
I wouldn't say that. I don't think staying the same. In what ways?
Well, physically, I'm thinking of mainly that there's physically. It looks, I know that you've worked on landscaping the rocks and so on, but the environment here is still pretty well preserved.
Yes, it still feels. South Coast is relatively undeveloped, and you really feel it. When the tourists are around, because there's so many less tourists down here, it's the vibe is so much quieter. I mean, having spent 8 years at Loma Vista in the middle of all that, I really saw the change up there, so hugely changed from when I started here. And down here, it's still pretty quiet. There's traffic because they're going through, but there's not the impact here.
Right.
Although the beaches get pretty crowded in the summer. And
like which beach are you?
Sand Dollar. Yeah,
Willow.
Sand Dollar is parking all over the highway, and that's been discovered. I mean, we've been discovered. There's no getting around it.
No.
But there's not very many places to stay or stop on the South Coast. There's Gorda, and they have a few rooms, and then there's Tree Bones. And Tree Bones has been a nice addition to the neighborhood because we have a restaurant in the neighborhood and a sushi bar.
Yeah.
It's fabulous.
Yeah.
Otherwise, there was nothing down here.
Right.
Have to drive. After PV burnt down, right. And we have to drive 45 minutes to go out to dinner in Cambria, or an hour to go out to the dinner up the coast.
What about Gorda?
Bunny is a baker there, yeah. And she does wonderful, wonderful baked goods.
Right, right. So let me just talk about one more thing, though. This, and I want to hear you. Sort of, it's hard because it's a very general question, and it's sort of an overview. But you really have had an extraordinary experience that not too many people have had, of being involved with Esalen from its very beginning,
mm-hmm,
until now. And you're still involved, you're still, mm-hmm, intimately involved with the place. So just in general, as someone who knows nothing about it, what to you has Esalen, what is it about, or maybe even what has it been about, what is it about now, if that's a valid question? Has it changed? You know, what is Esalen? Explain it to someone who doesn't know.
Esalen is about transformation, personal transformation, and on a bigger level, worldly transformation, but starting with the self. So people come there, like I did, seeking themselves, and often in transition in their lives, but kind of looking for their truth, looking to expand their awareness, looking for a practice to help them to go deeper inside. And over the years, and so they call it the human potential movement. That was a phrase that was developed in the 60s, and it refers to developing our potential and developing ourselves. And so the practices through the years have been all in pursuit of that development. So yoga, meditation, many kinds of therapy, many kinds of healing, massage, all kinds of practices have happened there, and it keeps changing and evolving as new things get introduced. They try and stay cutting edge, but cutting edge is different now than it was back in those days. And in the early days, there were real heroes and superstars, Alan Watts and Fritz Perls and George Leonard and Dick Price and Michael Murphy. I mean, these people were just so cutting edge.
Stan Grof,
Maslow, you know, it was an amazing collection of intelligent Gregory Bateson and intelligence and learning and fabulous stuff going on. And there's still amazing stuff going on, but we don't kind of have those same heroes anymore. People that we did in those days. But it's so interesting to me because all through the years, you know, so much has changed in terms of the politics and who runs it and the board of trustees. It's a nonprofit. It's run by a board of trustees. Michael, who started it with Dick Price, is still survives, and he's amazing. And so it's all of this is going on, and all of this is constantly changing, yet the magic still happens. No matter who's at the top spinning the story, mm-hmm, the magic still happens. And that, to me, is what's so fascinating about the place. And that says more to me about the place, and as I referred to earlier, the integrity of the place itself, that, mm-hmm, this can still happen here. And there's, you know, like any place, there's politics, mm-hmm, and there's backstabbing, and there's all the stuff that goes with human beings, you know, mm-hmm, the good, the bad, the ugly. And the magic still happens, you know, mm-hmm, it's just amazing. So it keeps me interested in that. I observe that, and I'm a part of that when I teach and when I give massage, and I see people coming there for the first time, and I'm just, you know, enthralled of watching their experience and how they're so taken by the place and so into it, and they, oh my God, and of course it's the beauty of the place, it's so beautiful, mm-hmm, and then the baths and the peacefulness of the baths, and yeah, mm-hmm, so it's a very magical place. And although there's been enormous change, it's still there.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you spoke of Esalen now like that, I thought to myself, we could have changed the word Esalen to Big Sur, almost.
Uh-huh.
Because there's a sort of a, perhaps some people think or feel that there's a magic to this,
right,
whole place.
Right.
The whole coast. So maybe in the same way, if you met someone in a restaurant in New York City who had never been to the West Coast, and you sat in a bar and you started talking, and they asked you, where are you from? And you would have said, I'm from Big Sur, and they would have said, what's that? What do you say to people like that today, you know, after all these years of being here? How do you explain Big Sur to someone?
Well, it's a most glorious, beautiful place in the central coast of California, undeveloped in the larger sense of the word, undeveloped. Mountains meet the ocean, very dramatic coastline, inhabited by free-thinking, spirited people who are there to express themselves and either through their art downfall.
Oops. Here's a dog up here. Bridget, go on.
Right in the mouth. To find expression in their art, mm-hmm. or creatively, mm-hmm. Who want to be removed from the materialism of the world, mm-hmm. and live a simpler life. And basically people who are looking for something other than what's out there in the bigger world.
Mm-hmm. There's a spiritual aspect, obviously, to this.
Yes,
right?
very much so.
You mentioned the word artists. Does the place draw that kind of person, do you think?
Definitely. The quiet here. An artist needs quiet to create. You know, and I mean, some artists, I guess, some create in the midst of New York City, and that works for them. But writers and painters and artists have always been drawn here because you don't have the distraction that you have out there in the world. And it's quiet, and it's so inspiring. The beauty is so inspiring, mm-hmm. that, you know, it just kind of cycles through you, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And even in the sense of our massage work, I mean, we practice right on the ocean. Our massage rooms are right on the ocean, you know, just 50 feet above the ocean. And so we have the waves cycling through us, the sound and the feeling of the waves. And that's contributed a lot to the way we've developed our work there.
Mm-hmm. I can imagine that sometimes you've been there maybe before the bats fell in the ocean or after. It doesn't really matter, but I kind of have my strongest memories from the old baths,
mm-hmm.
and being on top there, and I can imagine you being there and receiving someone from anywhere, but far away from here, in, let's say, Kansas City, whatever. They've never been to the coast before. It's the first time. And they step up to the table right there, and they lay down. I mean, there must have been moments that would have been, like you talked about before, transforming for those individuals, or very, very strong experience.
Yes, and I think it begins the moment they go down the hill and just see the beauty of Esalen. The first thing you see are the gorgeous gardens, you know, and the landscaping is beautiful. And so I think it's felt immediately. There's just a felt sense. Mm-hmm. And then they go to their group, and they're held in their group. They're supported. There's enormous support in most of these workshops, mm-hmm. for people and their transformation, and then they go to the baths,
right.
And the baths, you know, magnificent setting and beautiful baths, and then they have a massage, and then they never want to leave. And people say to me all the time, you know, I just don't want to go home, I just want to stay here.
Yeah, as it turns out, it'll be pretty expensive today.
Yes,
to do that.
Yes, yeah. It is. Although there are ways, as a work scholar,
yeah.
It's pretty affordable.
Yeah.
And you can always work there for a while. You don't make money, but you have the experience,
mm-hmm.
and so people do come and go a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's amazing that myself, Vicky, Deborah, and Brita have been there so long. They were all there when I got there,
mm-hmm.
so they've been there longer than me, and I'm going on my 46th year at Esalen. And it's only, I think, people... It's only us massage crew people who have maintained that longevity, and probably because we've been much less political than everybody else, you know.
Right.
And we just go and we do our thing and we teach and we...
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, and the practice itself is more sustainable than a lot of the other work there.
Mm-hmm.
People get burned out.
Mm-hmm. So, Jasmine and Lucia, they both went to Pacific Valley?
They both went to Pacific Valley, mm-hmm. Yes. And that was tough. I was very unsure about what to do about schooling here.
Yeah.
The school was crazy mess when they went there. Mm-hmm. I mean, crazy. And but we didn't have any options. I mean, I couldn't drive them every day to Cambria because I was working in the other direction. And I figured, well, you know, they'll get what they get and we'll supplement the rest. And I always traveled with them. I took them back to New York all the time because my family was there, and took them to the city, and we went to Jamaica, and Jasmine and I went to Paris, and we traveled, you know, so mm-hmm. that they had that exposure. And they also had the benefit of Esalen and this international crowd of people there. So they met people and adults and got used to relating to adults and people from all over the world from the time they were little, because mm-hmm. they always went there and went to gazebo until they started Pacific Valley. But even at Pacific Valley, they would come up there on the bus and meet me at the end of the day, and then we'd spend some time there, and then I'd drive them home here. So they always had Esalen. And when Lucia was about 16, she'd had enough of Pacific Valley School. And we had a principal there at the time, Bill Raby, who was very open-minded and a good educator. And he said, fine, what do you want to do? She said, I want to do my own program at Esalen. And here's what I want to do. I'm going to study art with Gary. I'm going to draw. I'm going to study massage and get my certification. I'm going to study music and learn to play guitar. And I'm going to learn yoga and learn to teach yoga. And she did all these things. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to write about it all.
Lucia.
Uh-huh. And I'm going to write about it all. And then she did all that, and she graduated.
Yeah, that's awesome.
She
yeah.
did. She graduated with one other person that year. It was Lucia and Willis. Hmm. Willis Withrow.
Oh,
Willis
yeah.
Withrow.
Right.
I don't know whether you know this, but yeah. he just got a job flying Air Force One.
I know.
Did you hear that?
I heard about that.
Yes.
No.
Yes. Willis.
R.
Willis.
How did he get security clearance?
And that's what I said. Exactly. They didn't go too far back, right? Oh, my God.
Wow.
I know.
That's so funny.
Isn't that something?
Yeah.
So that's what Lucia did. And then she started traveling. She went off to Brazil, and I don't know. And then she went to New York and studied with Gabrielle and started developing these five rhythms thing. And then she decided she needed to go to college. So she went to Goddard and did a sort of extended student program and got her bachelor's degree there. And that was great. She felt really good about that. Mm. And then she spent a lot of time in New York and started developing her five rhythms practice.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then she got into Buddhism, and she did 3-year apprenticeship teacher training with Noah Levine. And so now she's got that under her belt as well.
Yeah.
And she's sort of bringing both practices into her work. And
so the Pacific Valley school days probably didn't hurt them too much.
Didn't hurt them, and I've asked them both, you mm-hmm. know, because for a while Lucia was so miserable there. She said, I want to go away to school, I want to go to private school. And I said, you know, I don't want that. You're my kid, I want you with me. I want you home with me. I'm not sending you to private school. And it's just not going to happen. And so she kind of let that go, and I asked her later, you know, how does that feel now? And she said, no, I'm glad that I never went to private school. I'm glad we had what we had at Pacific Valley. And Jasmine had a little bit of better time. The school, we got rid of some of the druggies who were running the school. And you know, the school got better when Jasmine got there. She had a couple of very good teachers, and it improved. But when she was 17, she was on the same track. I'm out of here. I don't want to be here any longer. So she jammed, and she did 2 years in one, and she graduated when she was 17 years old and got out 1 year early. So both of them did that. Mm. I mean, I wish they'd had a better early education, but then she went on to college, and she went on and got her master's degree in teaching. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they did fine.
Good, yeah.
Ultimately, would have been nice if they'd had a better experience in school.
Right.
But it didn't kill their spirit. It didn't kill their desire to learn or their curiosity, as bad as it was.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's
so
that
overall then from this day here where you're dancing at Cafe Kiva or that is down at Kiva, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It was Amphora at the
Amphora
time.
Amphora at the time, right.
Mm-hmm.
Overall then again, you know, it's one of those general questions, but it's fun to hear your take on it. You've lived down here, so for you it's a little, the perspective is a little different. You go down this long drive from here past all of these incredibly busy road construction spaces like Rain Rock and all these places for years, right? I mean, always a disaster.
Always.
Lucia, right? I mean, everywhere. So your perspective is the highway is a very big part of your life.
Yes, yes. And it's much better now. They take much better care of it now than they did back then. Robin and I used to commute to Esalen together. And she was such a cowboy. She just charged through some of these places when they were working on them. But it was very scary. I remember Lucia when it was dipping towards the ocean like this, and we took that road, and it was just slanted, just like that. Just it was so scary. And we did a lot of runs. Well, she and I did a lot of midwife runs in the middle of the night on this road too, and the rainstorms and all kinds of things. We got through one year. Came from a birth up on Pfeiffer Ridge, and the road closed right behind us. Right behind us. Just bam! All these rocks came down. We just made it through. So crazy.
How did that start, the midwifery?
Oh, it started. It was Brita was pregnant with Ivy. It was before I had children, maybe 1974. And she was living at Jade Cove. And she was with Horst Mayer, well, sort of. He was the dad. And she was going to have a baby at home. And she had a nurse friend who was supposed to come and assist her.
Is this Brita Ultra?
Yeah. 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 And Vicky and Deborah and I said we would come too and help her. I had never been to a birth, ever. I didn't know anything about birth. Vicky and Deborah knew something. Having both given birth, but at a very young age. So we show up, and the nurse doesn't. So there we are, the three of us and Horst. Horst is freaking useless. He goes upstairs.
Describe Horst briefly.
Horst was an artist, Austrian, very severe kind of person, amazing photographer and an artist.
Painter?
Yeah. No, he was sort of an architect and a photographer. Mm-hmm. His beautiful photography he did. And he did a lot of building on the coast. And he was a ladies' man. He had a family with four girls at home at Big Creek, not even home away. Right here. I mean, this is how crazy it was in those days. And so they were having this baby together. And so anyway, he was useless. And I felt useless, but I just kind of went along with what was happening, and we all encouraged her and worked with her, and the baby was born. And I was psychedelic. Oh my God, this baby, this birth, oh my God, there's a living being right here in our presence. And so I was transformed in that moment, and for days I walked around, my pupils huge. I mean, I was completely transformed by this experience. It was so amazing to me. And Honey Rose was a midwife, and she started practicing on the coast and delivering babies, and she had so many children, she needed help. So I started going to births with her, because I just couldn't not go to births. I wanted to go right away as soon as this happened, you know. And so Honey started taking me, and I would take care of the babies, and then I started having babies, and I got more and more into it.
You mean you started having...
My own babies.
Delivering babies,
no,
or your own babies.
No, birthing myself,
right, right.
And Honey was my midwife.
Right.
And then Honey stopped at some point, and then Robin and I started working together, and then Mary Lou joined us, and we did it maybe, 15 years or so. Yeah, and then we stopped. Yeah, we stopped at some point. It was enough. But that was another thing that, like the belly dancing, I was just completely captured by this birthing and this midwifery thing. And, you know, again, outlaws. We had no licenses. We had no formal training. I did go to school. I went to Santa Cruz to the Institute of Feminine Arts.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to a couple of midwives in Monterey who taught me. And I apprenticed with Honey, but that's pretty much hands-on learning, you know, a little bit of book learning.
Right.
And I studied myself, but, you know, God knows. I was thinking about it last night. I mean, the risks that we took, but we had such faith in these women and in our intuition to know when it was time to go if we needed to transport. Mm-hmm. We never lost a baby. We never lost a mom. We had some close calls with bleeding and with, you know, prolonged labor, but we always got there on time. And that was a huge blessing for us all.
How many do you think that you did in?
About 100. Yeah, and some were hospital births. We would go and coach in the hospital. That was never satisfying for me, though, the way the home birth was.
Right.
Especially if it was a planned hospital birth. If it was a transport, it was different. But if it was a planned hospital birth, it just didn't have the same vibe at all. Right. You know, the home births were magical, beautiful, amazing experiences.
In a way, you have a very, very large family.
Yeah. Yeah, and I see these kids all grown up with their own kids.
Right.
Or I see them, they're waiters at Nepenthe. I think I was at your birth. I can't even remember them all.
Right, you know? Of course.
I have to ask Robin sometimes, were we there?
So, I mean, the motivation for you to do that had nothing really to do. I mean, obviously, at a certain point, you got paid to help out, of course, and or at least reimbursed and probably paid. But the motivation for doing that was never about income, right?
Oh, no. There was no income. In the beginning,
no.
We would be a dozen eggs in an abalone shell, you know?
Right, right.
There was none of that. I mean, finally, by the time we stopped, we had our fee up to about $850, but that was over all those years, and it was never about that. We would be happy to trade, you know?
Yeah.
It was just a service we were passionate about providing for our community. We so believed that women should be empowered and that women should have the choice, and that women should be able to birth in the comfort of their home with their families and not with doctors and intervention. Oh, I get so emotional when I think about what happens in the hospital. And we were so passionate about it that we just had to do it.
Yeah.
We could not do it,
right,
you know.
Right.
And it was hard on Dick because I would leave the house in the middle of the night.
2 a.m., yeah.
2 a.m., and it was raining. I'd leave him with the kids, and so then he'd have to do all that. And, you know, he was supportive, but he didn't love it. You know, he was also supportive when it was time to quit. And my girls were supportive. They actually loved that I was doing that and got to come with me once in a while to a birth and see it. But one Christmas, when Leah had her baby, I missed Christmas morning. And that was the worst sin of my whole midwifery career. Because I was in the hospital in San Luis. The road was closed up north. Leah goes into labor Christmas Eve, and she's got, I can't remember the circumstances why we ended up going to the hospital, but we couldn't go north, so we had to go south. And she labored all night long. Finally, the baby came, maybe late morning. I got home, you know, early afternoon. But it was, you know, they never forgot that. Dick will tell you, if midwifery comes up, that'll be his story. She missed all these holidays. She went from one Christmas to all these days.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. But that was a wonderful time for me. And
do you think that now, if you look at it now, is it equally motivating now for someone in your shoes? Let's say we just, you know, someone comes in here and they want to help people deliver in the community here now, because there aren't, you really were the couple who did it, and I don't think I guess there are a few people around that you can call on, but since you disappeared, most women have their babies in hospital now.
Many do, but there's some young midwife teams in Monterey now who have sort of taken over. And
have things gotten better, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not so in touch with the process.
Right.
Somewhat better, but midwives still have no hospital privileges at CHOMP, which is absurd.
Mm-hmm.
They do at Natividad now.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of these, this team of midwives in Monterey can practice at Natividad.
Mm-hmm.
So they can go there and deliver a baby, and that's, we were always hoping that would happen at CHOMP. CHOMP is a very conservative medical facility.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it, I don't know if it's better. It's better in that midwives now can be certified and can, they're not outlaws the way we were. We mm-hmm. were always scared to death, you know. That, I mean, not really, but yeah. that was there.
Yeah.
That something could happen. We, people around us were. We weren't. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been doing it. We were fine. We trusted.
Yeah.
Maybe foolishly, but we did, and we didn't get in any trouble, but we could have. We could have been arrested. We could have been arrested for practicing without a license, and we could have been arrested if anything had happened. Well, one of our midwife friends was, when she lost a baby up in Palo, Colorado, there was a big trial, and it was a whole hoo-ha, and she ended up not doing any jail time, but I can't remember what the outcome was, but she got off.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I remember.
Community service.
Yeah, community service.
Yeah.
So we took big chances. It was risky, and my father hated it. He used to go, oh, why do you do this? Oh, my God. Why? He was a lawyer. Why do you do this? Oh, my God. Why do you do this? I don't know why I do this. I can't not do this.
Well,
yeah.
Well.
Yeah. Yeah, so that was a big, wonderful piece of my history here that I'm very grateful for, and I just fell into it,
mm-hmm.
you know, and all these things that I've fallen into and have been so passionate about, I never in my New York world would have ever, they weren't even in my consciousness, massage or midwifery,
right.
or none of this,
no,
you know,
no.
I would never have thought of any of this.
Yeah. So how has Big Sur then changed as a whole, do you think? Since you came,
well,
over the years, what has
San Francisco
happened?
And LA have discovered it, so mm-hmm. it's been inundated. It's been, you know, many tourists come now, which is lovely. I'm fine sharing it, but it's a little overcrowded, and the same has happened at Esalen. You know, Esalen has gotten famous, and Esalen is too crowded now.
Mm-hmm.
Too many people there, and it's too hard on the land. You know, and they try to keep it down, but you know, how do you control a growing organism, which
right.
is what happens here. I
yeah.
mean, people talk about controlling it and closing this and shutting this and stopping this and stopping that, but it just doesn't see, it seems to be against nature, you
yeah.
know, things
yeah.
grow.
Yeah.
And I think we can, you know, put parameters around things and try and control certain aspects, but, you know, growth is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
What can you do?
Mm-hmm.
We can't control it. It's just like the people who are moving in here. In the old days, it was artists. It was Emil White and Henry Miller and people like that were coming here. Well, now it's wealthy people with, you know, out of .com
yeah.
bill who can buy and sell, you
mm-hmm.
know, a million times.
Yeah.
And so how do you stop that or change that? You don't. I mean,
yeah.
you just
yeah.
watch it.
Yeah.
Watch it. Maybe sadly, but...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. My inclination is always sort of going with the flow and not trying to stop the river,
mm-hmm.
you know. And I just don't see how you stop what's happening here. Maybe we can get better at what we do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I don't have any answers.
No.
Yeah.
I don't. It's difficult. I mean, I think when it comes to the you know, let's not talk about this, but the highway though, it's only two lanes.
Right.
And, you know, as you said, this summer, last summer or summer before that, in the last two years especially, it has just suddenly exploded, really exploded, where there were times this summer and last summer where we almost had a gridlock.
Yeah.
You know, and if that happens, then it's not a matter of...
It's safety.
Yeah, exactly. Then we have to do something. And
well,
so,
I've thought about toll
yeah,
road, you
right.
know, that concept, it doesn't...
It comes
completely
up.
Repel me.
No, it has come up now, actually,
uh-huh.
in official... They mentioned it at the multi-agency council.
Yeah.
But
I mean, it's not a terrible idea.
Oh.
It certainly would limit,
yeah.
maybe.
Yeah.
Imagine, and I mean, the highway was so empty in the old days. On a full moon, you could drive without your lights,
mm-hmm.
you know. There was just nobody out there. I mean, Douglas used to ride his horses down the middle of the road, you know. And those days are gone, but... Things change.
Yeah. Peggy, I think we're done.
Okay.
Right? I
mean, yeah,
that was fun.
Sit
for a long time to go.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, yeah? Uh-huh, in the full moon. Yeah, yeah. I was thinking of the pickup truck when we came out of Palo, Colorado with that woman bleeding out and you with the baby and Robin with her fist inside and me with my eyes plugged into hers. And the husband driving this rickety old truck down the worst road in the whole freaking world.
And that treehouse, we got her out along the ramp.
Oh my God, that treehouse.
And Robin, if she let go of that vein, she started to bleed out.
Yeah.
I don't know how she kept that. Her hand had to be cramping so badly.
Oh.
That, I mean, and we had to figure out how to get a ramp to get this mom on there and not have her fall off
and not bleed. And then we had to get her down this road, and then we had Theron with us. He was a baby. Maybe you had Theron.
No,
do you remember?
I stayed with you guys in the back of the car.
In the back of the, so somebody had Theron.
Right. I don't remember him being there.
I don't remember either, but I remember her being worried about them taking him because the policewoman was down there waiting for us, whatever her name was, and we were so thankful it was her because we didn't know who was going to, we knew somebody was going to be there with the ambulance from the sheriff or the police department, but we thought, oh God, they can take us too, you know?
Right, I remember on top of all that.
So, but they didn't, they let us all, we all went into the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a very freaky, but it had to happen there, 100 miles back, Palo, Colorado Road.
She gave her birth and her placenta, and then it had, the baby had rubbed a vein, so raw, she was so thin, right? Isn't that what happened?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, Robin thought it might have been the fact that she tried to keep the baby inside. Remember, I think because we weren't there yet or something, and she didn't want to push. But the doctor, Dr. Vogelpohl, was the doc, and he said, you know, occasionally a woman has a vein that's very close to the, under the skin, and this happens. He said it's 1 in 100 million, and, you know, it happens.
And she was a nurse.
Yeah, she was a nurse.
The woman that was mama.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember her name, but Robin said she saw her one time after that, and she'd had a second baby and also had complications, different ones, I think, but something else. So that was the worst nightmare for me.
I think that's when everybody decided to retire. That was it, wasn't that?
No, we went on after that. But I remember that nurse from Natividad called us. There was a doctor-nurse backup team, and he got arrested for child porn, the doctor, and we were all so horrified. And the wife had divorced him, but she was still the nurse midwifery practicing there. And she called up one day and said, I'm done. I don't want to see any of your people anymore. It's too risky. I don't want to do this anymore. I don't want to back you up anymore. Have a nice life.
Oh my God.
And so she backed out. And so it's just everything sort of came together. And I just lost the passion, you know. I was so far away from my own birth. And people were calling me I didn't know. And I'm not a professional. What am I doing, you know?
Right.
I was just doing this as a community service.
That was right.
Yeah, that was right.
Yeah.
I was definitely not a professional.
Right.
It was we were doing it for the love of our friends and, you know, helping people we cared about, but we were not in it to be professionals. So it all just seemed right at the time. And it was hard to give up because I had such an identity as a midwife, you know, it was this ego trip, but it was nonetheless, it was real. So it was sort of hard to walk away from that.
Mm-hmm.
And, but you know,